The meeting of the Watersheds, Wetlands, and Buffers Subcommittee will come to order. This is an actual formal hearing, a meeting of the subcommittee. We've been touring all day, so I've been asked by members to let the audience know we don't always dress this casually, but we have been on the road since 8 this morning visiting sites throughout southern Minnesota, and it has been a very informative tour, and I want to start out just by thanking all the folks who've made the tour possible. My name is Rick Hansen. I serve as chair of this subcommittee. It's a subcommittee of the Environmental Finance Committee. And our focus is primarily on the Board of Water and Soil Resources budget. And we do have just a little housekeeping to do before we get started. I want to have staff conduct the roll call. And we do have some other members here who will I want to also recognize. First, we have Representative Osmond, who is the ranking member of the full Environmental Finance Committee. Doesn't serve on this committee, but has a great history in this area, and we wanted to make sure that that he would be here. Representative Poppy, we've been throughout your district today looking at ditches and we know you're very close to this district, and Representative Welty, whose host district it is in, and we'd like to offer Representative Welty the chance to welcome us here. So,
thank you, Representative Hansen. First of all, I want to thank all of the representatives who took the time to venture down to southeast Minnesota to tour. I know you've been seeing many different projects in this area. You've seen projects that were put into place in the past related to the state programs that are out there. And then also, we had a focus today on the devastation that that occurred because of the flooding in this area. The dollars that went out in the special session legislation, how those dollars are being used, you're going to hear a little bit about that tonight in the testimony. For about an hour, Bowser will describe how the dollars have been allocated and the projects that are being put on the ground in place to sustain the soil in the areas that have been heavily washed out because of the substantial rains and flooding. But the other part of this hearing will be focusing on what we've done in the past here in southeast Minnesota and what we want to see in the future to conserve our soil, to conserve our natural resources. And of course, as all of you are touring around here today, you got an opportunity to see this area. You know that it's an area of rolling hills. It's very wooded in certain areas, and then in other areas we have a lot of tillable acres. We have some challenges in southeastern Minnesota. We've had a lot of dairy farms, smaller dairy farms in the past that have gone out of business, either due to the parents leaving the farm and no one there to take over, or just for the fact that in different economic times that we've been through in the past and different cycles, we've lost some of our dairy farms. So if you talk to the farmers in the area and talk to the landowners out in the townships, you will hear the issues of loss of legumes, loss of alfalfa, loss of pasture on our hillsides where we used to see that. And so there are issues that we have with soil erosion that are taking place. So the challenges that we have are we have less cover crops holding the soil in place in southeast Minnesota. And 5 to 10 years ago, when a lot of the CRP was being reapportioned around the country, Minnesota and southeast Minnesota lost quite a few acres of CRP. Structures and practices of the past are being removed, and we see that throughout this area. Size of the equipment is increasing, of course, as agriculture changes and farmers want to become more efficient with the land that they're using. And we have fewer contour strips and waterways in place. However, on the positive side, we see that waterways are being replaced, ones that have filled in, and we see new methods of holding soil in place. And Andy Hart, one of our area farmers and Soil Water Conservation District supervisor, will talk about aerial seeding and ryegrass seeding and cover crop. And in this area of southeastern Minnesota, the farmers are beginning to talk about it. They're seeing it in the papers. Andy's been very instrumental in spreading the word about this program. And it's a program that we're seeing results of, and we're seeing more cover crop that's being put in place in the fall so that when spring comes around, we have less soil erosion. Another thing that is key to this area is we've had organized efforts through the Whitewater Watershed Project and the Zembro River Watershed Partnership. And these were put in place to work with property owners throughout the watersheds to implement soil and water conservation methods. And you'll hear more about that in the group presentation. And actually, the Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors and the partnerships that I've talked about and others in this area have all banded together. They've been working together for quite a long time. Many of them know each other. And they actually got together and planned the presentation that you're going to see here tonight. You're not going to see individual presentations. They actually have one big PowerPoint presentation. That just proves how much work they're doing here in southeast Minnesota. And it's very important that we increase the conditions of the soil fertility, the water quality, agriculture, and our environment. If we don't continue to work towards improving our practices and continue to try to achieve a goal of reducing soil erosion in the future, we're going to continue to see the depletion of our resources. And if it continues, or if we see the trend of the past, Lake Zumbro, which you're going to hear about later, will continue to fill up with sediment, and we'll hear about issues in the future of having to dredge our water bodies. And if the soil continues to erode, could end up in the Gulf of Mexico, of course, or down the Mississippi River. So we want to make sure that we keep our soil here. We want to keep our water bodies clean. It's good for the environment and good for agriculture. So tonight, again, you're going to hear a comprehensive report from southeastern Minnesota. I want to thank all of those of you who have taken the time to come here to share our story of what is occurring, to talk about the challenges of the past, the challenges of the future, and how the state of Minnesota can better work with our landowners in the area so that we can meet the challenges of the future. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a hearing where we will take public comment. There is an agenda by the table. You will see a number of names on there, but if anyone does want to address the committee, I would encourage you to sign up. We will have the opportunity if anyone wants to speak to the committee. We will be fairly free-flowing. I think that you will find that members will ask questions as the process goes on, if that is okay. As you're addressing us, we are going to ask questions. We usually do. I know that Representative Gunther has a whole bunch of them ready, so he's ready to go. So, Melissa, if you want to first introduce yourself and the role you have, and then maybe do the roll call.
Okay. I'm Melissa Huygens, the committee legislative assistant, and Representative
Hanson. Here.
Ex officio.
And Representative Peterson did join us on the tour earlier, but couldn't make the meetings. And maybe we also have Janelle. Do you want to just introduce yourself and staff? Jenna. With that, I think we'll start right into testimony from local officials, Andy Hart and George Polk. And are all 12 going to speak at the same time? Or?
Let me moderate here for a little bit.
Okay, Jim.
We just got this agenda as of 2 minutes ago, but we kind of knew what was going on. And basically what is going to occur, we did take a comprehensive, in respect for your time on the road, we did take a comprehensive look and blended a lot of these things together. Each person will come up, testify before you. They'll have a little segment of the PowerPoint, and they will get up. Other person will come in and introduce themselves. After that, the Lake Zumbro Improvement Corporation will give a short testimony specifically about Lake Zumbro and some special need there. Then myself and Rudy will talk about from Soil and Water Conservation District point of view. We'll entertain questions during that time, and then we can have the follow-up speaker, Andy Toole, talk about his issue. So I'll start out with Norm Sinjin with the PowerPoint.
If you could just mention your name and who you represent first.
I am Tim Terrell from the Winona Soil and Water Conservation District.
Thank you. Mr. Sinjin.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here to tell you about southeastern Minnesota. My name is Norman Sinjin, and I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in the Rochester office. And I'm going to start out by giving you sort of an overview of issues and in southeastern Minnesota. Let's see here. You'll have to face this way, I guess. This is the agenda for the evening. I'm doing the overview, then we'll have four issues we want to highlight for you. The nitrate problem that's been increasing in intensity over the years, soil erosion and sedimentation, which is very much of a problem here, hazards from intensive storms, which you've seen some evidence of today, and then some thoughts on Clean Water Legacy Act funding of local units of government and how that might be made more efficient in the future. We're here kind of under this umbrella of the Basin Alliance for the Lower Mississippi and Minnesota. Some of you, I think Representative Osment, you've been on BALM tours before, and we sort of, it's a PCA, they allow me to kind of coordinate down here. They actually pay me to do this job. So I'm happy to be here to try to give you an overview. It's a little bit distorted here, I see, but we're not quite as long and tall as that. But we are all of the tributaries between the Minnesota River Basin and Wisconsin that flow into the Mississippi, from the Vermilion up to down to the Root, including Cedar. And the Zumbro, the Root is where we are this evening. Key basin characteristics, and I think Representative Welty has already stolen some of my thunder already, but I'll just hit the high points here. The karst landscape, I'm sure you saw some evidence of that today, limestone bluffs, outcroppings. We have shallow soil over fractured bedrock with large solution cavities with a high potential for contamination of groundwater. And there are a lot of concerns about contaminants that reach the groundwater and that can get into the wells. Blufflands, kind of the surface aspect of that is we have high soil erosion rates. There's a lush soil, very loosely bound, that's on the soil surface. We have cold water fishery, very high quality. Cold streams, 736 miles or so of designated trout streams. And it's a traditional dairy region, but we've been losing a lot of dairy, and that's affected the landscape a lot. So that's the karst area around the east, and we're, Highway 52 is just kind of almost the dividing between the east and the west. We have the headwaters, the flat part, it's more like the Minnesota River, the flat prairie. And there, originally it was wet prairie and savanna. It is now intensive agriculture, row crops. It's been drained extensively for that, and that is affecting the hydrology in that part of the region. And there's swine, beef, dairy production. And there the streams are smaller, the headwater streams, and they're very sensitive to the extremes of hydrology, drought, and this year's flood. So well, we had a little bit of each this year. Early it was dry, and then we got torrential rain. Some of the key issues here, and this is from kind of the left side here is sort of, an impaired waters view of the world, if you will. The impairments are turbidity. I think I counted them up. We have 70 or so. I mean, the more we monitor, the more we find exceedances of turbidity or suspended solids in streams. And that's an aquatic life impairment. A fecal coliform bacteria, we have completed a TMDL on that. We've done a lot to implement it, but we're on the average twice as much fecal bacteria in the water as there should be, according to the standards, and sometimes it's much, much higher than that. We have pesticides for the first time this year on our draft impaired waters list. We have acetochlor listed in the white water on the draft. That may or may not transpire. We have the next grouping is lakes, and we don't have a lot of lakes here. Some of them are artificial, you know, reservoirs. You have to get out to Faribault to find lakes in a different ecoregion. But here we have, you know, Lake Pepin, Billisby, and Zumbro. And you're going to hear more about that, but we have phosphorus impacts there that cause eutrophication. It's a concern. Those are all listed as impaired. And nitrate nitrogen is not listed as impaired, but we have a lot of, there's a lot of concerns. It's, as you'll hear in the next presentation, it's a problem that's getting worse over the years, and it's a concern for drinking water here. On the other hand, on the right side, we have high potential for restoration here, say, I think compared to more just strictly corn, soybeans, and livestock regions. There's more, a little bit more pasture and hay still, although it's becoming less. We have some forestry around the river, so a little bit more diversity and more to work with to start out. Karst landscape, there's a lot of attention given to this, and you see the intensity, the ground cover, I think, on the right side, it's the red is 50 feet or less of topsoil over the bedrock, and then it gets deeper as you go further west. Extreme water erosion potential, the greatest in the state, and So there's a big emphasis on reducing that potential, making sure it's not realized. We are connected to the Mississippi River, and sometimes that connection doesn't look so pretty. This, I think, was 1999, August, after a 1-inch or 2-inch rain. That's how the Root River impacting the Mississippi. And we have channel sedimentation in the Mississippi, backwater sedimentation, and habitat destruction. So these tributaries do have an impact on our great river, the Mississippi. One of the things that really is, if there's a number one concern, I'd say that people talk about, it's the change in land use over time. And a lot of that is precipitated by the demise of dairy, or the structural change in dairy, away from small pasture-based operations more to confined systems, larger systems. And just some of the data between 1982 and 97, a 15-year period, there was a 28% decline in perennial cover on farmland in this region, a dramatic decline. And NRCS, that was NRCS data, quit collecting and producing that data after 97, unfortunately. With other sources, a whitewater watershed survey done by the Department of Agriculture between 1 and 97 and 1 and 06, we see corn and soybean acreage increasing from 70 to 78% of farmland. So even after that date, after that 28% decline, we still see greater increases. And then the last influence that we're concerned about here is what is ethanol, the ethanol push going to do? The high corn prices and soybean prices. We've seen, I checked on this, you know, planting intentions statewide were up 8% in 2007. We will know what actually happened in March next year, but it's a trend that's continuing to focus on row crops. Emerging issue, as I mentioned before, pesticides in surface water and groundwater, and as you'll hear later, you know, for here, surface water and groundwater, it's the same molecule ends up in both areas very rapidly because of the parts. So we have atrazine detections. We have concentrations that have exceeded the standard at the peak flows in the springtime. It's not yet listed as impaired. It hasn't quite tripped the trigger, but it's come close. And there are health concerns about groundwater. It's, you know, the listing criteria are for surface water, aquatic life impairment, but as you've probably all heard, there are concerns about human health at very much lower levels, and that'll maybe be worked out future standard development. But acetochlor is the one that is now listed on the draft list for the Whitewater River, so that would be really a rather a new development that we do a TMDL on acetochlor. So next, we go to nitrates.
I'm Terry Lee. I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for Olmsted County. And Olmsted County is your host this evening, so I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of Olmsted County. We'll talk about briefly about nitrates. Nitrogen fertilizer is used extensively in southeastern Minnesota, primarily for the corn crop. And we've seen the nitrate concentrations increasing steadily over the decades. In the 1990s in the Whitewater River Basin, we were seeing 9 parts per million in the stream system. We're getting very close to the drinking water standard. The primary source down here is commercial fertilizer, as I mentioned, for corn. And we are concerned because as the ethanol boom occurs, we're seeing more corn planted, and that's going to invariably translate into higher nitrates in both our groundwater and our surface water. This is a graphic just illustrating the nitrogen fertilizer trends, or sales trends, and you can see in 1960 we had virtually no commercial fertilizer sales in Minnesota. And by the time I started with Olmsted County in 1984, we were at levels that are about comparable to what we're seeing today. And we are seeing slight increases now, but we really haven't seen the increase that's anticipated in 2007. That doesn't show up on the graph. If you look at nitrate probability, the likelihood that we're going to see our nitrates in groundwater, you can see that it increases as you go across from west to east. And this is just an illustration through the area where we are today. The purple color is the most sensitive to groundwater pollution. And I listed 4 of the communities there, Rochester to give you a sense of place, St. Charles, Utica, and Lewiston in Winona County. And all 3 of those are experiencing some challenges with nitrates. This illustration here shows the nitrate levels in 3 wells that serve the city of Lewiston, the furthest east of the 3 communities that are on the illustration. And the nitrate levels are high enough where they have to start mixing the water with deeper aquifer water, which has high radium. So it's not a simple solution in this region for us just to simply go down into deeper aquifers. In Utica, which is the next community, is very much in that same situation and likely to have to have a similar compromise in the near future. The other thing that goes on is those shallow aquifers feed our stream. The purple dots on the map on the left are springs that are coming out of the area, what we call the Galena Aquifer. And you can see that in cross-section on the right side. Very high nitrates. In the Rochester area, when we've done studies of that aquifer, we see nitrate levels of about 20 parts per million, about 2 times the drinking water standard. Back in the late 1980s, we found out that about half of the city of Rochester's drinking water comes from that aquifer as it spills over a shale bed called the Decorah Shale and recharges those underlying aquifers. So not only is the high nitrate a concern for our stream, but it has the potential to be a concern for our drinking water supplies in all of our communities in this extreme area of southeastern Minnesota. The next presenter will be Linda Dahl talking about sediment.
I'm Linda Dahl, coordinator of the Whitewater Watershed Project, and the next issue we're going to be discussing tonight is one of the most significant issues in southeast Minnesota is soil erosion and sedimentation. The impacts of sedimentation in the rivers in the southeast are the turbidity blocks of sunlight, impact the fish respiration and covers the substrate of the bottom of the stream beds. Inorganic sediments are the major source. Go ahead. Thank you. We have some unique characteristics in southeast Minnesota, as a lot of you probably know, but this is kind of the foundation for why this is an issue here. And these are 3 different things that added together create challenges. The first one is that we have highly erodible soils. These soils down here are silt-based, less wind-deposited soils that are just naturally highly erodible by themselves. On top of that, we have steep slopes. 49% of southeast Minnesota has a greater than 6% slope. A lot of the slopes are 45 to 70% slopes. And then on top of that, you add the highest annual precipitation in Minnesota. Southeast Minnesota receives about 33 to 34 inches per year. So when you combine these factors, you come up with some challenges as far as dealing with stormwater and sedimentation. So now Terry and I are going to kind of go back and forth a little bit. He's going to talk about sediment issues with Lake Zumbro.
And I'm just going to be very brief on the Lake Zumbro sedimentation. This is just a series of maps from 1919 through 2005 where we actually had the bottom of the lake map. And so there was a study done to compare the rates of sedimentation. And while the rates were the most intense during the period 1919 to 1957, there's still substantial sediment getting into the lake, and that's one of the focuses of our project in Osage County and the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. And when we look at that, we see that not only is it sediment, but it also delivers phosphorus into the lake bed. Not only is it Lake Zumbro, while Lake Zumbro is in this immediate area, Lake Pepin's also filling up at about 10 times the resettlement rate. So it's a region-wide problem, not just this area. The reason we're focused on Lake Zumbro is because it's such an important recreational lake in our area. Now, Dean's not going to use any slides when he talks about it, but you can see that within about a 15-mile radius of the lake there, there's a very large population. You have all of Rochester and a number of small communities. It has the highest population relative to lake area in all of outstate Minnesota, or greater Minnesota. And Dean will talk a little bit about the plan that's being prepared to restore the lake.
Okay. There's a few trends going on right now. One is a positive trend towards more conservation tillage. On the flip side is a decrease in perennial cover, less hay, less contour strips, less buffering. These trends tend to lead to a decrease in the soil till, decrease organic matter in the soil, which decreases the soil's ability to hold water, and the annual disturbance of the soil, especially in the spring, makes it especially vulnerable for erosion. Another issue is development on steep slopes. Homes are being built on the side of bluffs, often with slopes 20, 30, or even 40%. Driveways to these buildings are definitely pose a problem. And oftentimes, as you can see on this, it's pretty common to bench, create a building site on steep slopes, results and all of these things add up to stormwater and erosion issues. And these sites are unstable and pose long-term challenges for managing soil erosion and stormwater. Another issue with soil erosion and sedimentation is in the floodplains themselves, managing the floodplains, cropping right up to the flood to the stream itself and developing in the floodplain. There's widespread non-compliance with the state shoreline ordinance requiring permanent vegetation within 50 feet of protected waters and inadequate enforcement of those ordinances. And we also need better management of the land occupied by the streams at high water. So within the riparian corridor, we need to compliance with the very minimum of 50-foot setback required in the shoreline ordinance. And in the floodplains themselves to dedicate that area to a land use that is compatible, that can withstand flooding and with minimal damage and provide soil and water quality protection and wildlife habitat.
For a second, we have a number of questions.
Thank you. First of all, I have to commend all of you. You're doing a wonderful job on this presentation. It's flowing right along. I can tell you spent time putting it together. My question is, you're talking about the 50-foot setback and shoreland ordinance, and I know that issue has come up down here, and it's come through to my office. And one of my questions on that is, are a lot of landowners just not aware of that standard? And if you go out and meet with the landowners and talk to them, do you get compliance, a high rate of compliance? By just educating people on that?
Yeah, I think there is very little knowledge that there is an ordinance. I don't think people know that this is the law, that they should have a 50-foot setback. On the flip side, when you do go out and visit them, there are also challenges because it's not being enforced, and it's a difficult management issue. I think it takes repeated visits, it takes education, and also compensation. Sometimes it's very valuable cropland right there along the stream, and people can be hesitant to make those changes. So even when they do know that it's an ordinance, it can still be a hump to get over in order to make that change.
All right, thank you.
Does anyone else have any questions? Okay, Ms. Dahl.
Finally, the needs that we face in Southeast Minnesota dealing with erosion and sedimentation challenges include one, to increase the water retention in the uplands. That can be through perennial vegetation, cover crops, paved strips, contour strips of grass, including as well as erosion control practices such as water and sediment basins, which you can see up on the picture, wetlands and terraces. And I think we can encourage these sorts of practices through supporting perennial fuels, alternative crops, diverse cropping systems, as well as supporting a system that compensates farmers based on conservation. And finally, better management of the critical slopes and the floodplains. I think the key to that is coordination between the county and the state government to support those ordinances that are already on the books.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dahl, we saw the creek that you took us out to, and we saw the erosion was, and we saw the devastation that creek had because of the floods, trees uprooted and so forth. Southern Minnesota and Martin County, we don't see those things.
Mm-hmm.
We have water flowing both north and south in one county. We're kind of flood-proof. it was really something to see that there was nothing protecting the soil next to the river, hardly at all, in that one area. And I really believe, as you said, this is partially due to the fact that we are losing the dairy industry. Is there any way, would it make any sense at all, in finding some way to rejuvenate the dairy industry through price supports of some kind? I know the federal marketing order for dairy is very anti-Minnesota and Wisconsin. Is there any way that we as a legislature that you can think of from the state of Minnesota that we can enhance the dairy industry so we could have the various things that we used to have?
Yeah, I do. I see a lot of, there's a lot of beginning farmers, and dairy is a great place for beginning farmers to come through. And I think supporting beginning farmers through, you know, Department of Agriculture, et cetera, can be one step. Another is, and I know this is a federal issue, but it takes everybody, which is, hay isn't a commodity crop. And a lot of times it's a liability for farmers. It makes them ineligible for programs. It cuts down on their corn base. And that simple change could make such a huge difference. So those are a couple thoughts that come to mind.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I really believe that if we can rejuvenate the dairy industry and find other uses for it. I know Kemp's in Rochester does a wonderful job. I think YoJ or whatever they call it, you know, and all the stuff that they have done over the years. I'm a grocer, by the way. So I think their creativity, along with a little bit of help from us, maybe we could do something like that. I know there is a beginning farmer program. Andy, I think you're still on the Ag Committee.
I actually have a bill that you would be really interested in.
Bring it around. I know there used to be a $250,000 low interest loan for beginning dairy farmers. And I imagine, like everything else today, that probably doesn't go as far as trying to adjust that for inflation or something, but it seems to me that we would take care of a lot of problems if we could somehow rejuvenate that industry, especially here. We don't have the dairy industry where I live. It's all the hog industry.
Yeah, well, and a lot of the dairies that we have are concentrated in, and sometimes they don't even grow their hay here. They bring it in from out west. So we're not seeing the benefits. So it's really the small dairies that are at our forage base that are the key, I think, to this area, and it's unique to this area, I think.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes. To that particular point, are there any efforts, or would they even be practical, to encourage or help farmers transition from traditional dairy to organic dairy? I know that the milk that my family drinks is Organic Valley, and they have, when I went to their bottling plant, which was Schroeder's, they said they were having trouble getting enough milk product, and that was their biggest issue. That wasn't too long ago. It maybe have changed, but is there any way to help people transition to a market that seems to be growing very rapidly?
Ms. Dahl.
Yeah, that's a great question. There is that three-year hump that a transitioning farmer has to get over before they can utilize their crops as organic. And so that the EQIP program through NRCS has been traditionally a good tool. Over just maybe 3-4 years ago, they offered an incentive for transitioning farmers. And that's only available once a year, but something like that pays the farmer a certain amount of money per acre during that transition time, because sometimes they're not getting a whole lot of income off that land. Not only can they not sell it as organic, but they also, oftentimes you can't just take a farm that's been corn and soybeans for 20 years and plant it organically for 3 years. You have to build the soil up, and that's kind of the premise of organic, is building the soil. And so you might have to plant cover crops and green manure and be tilling it in, and you're not making any money off of that land. So I really think that, yes, there needs to be some sort of incentive program for beginning organic.
Representative Wagenius.
I would be curious, since I don't sit on the Ag Committee, if anybody has proposed some sort of transitional program from traditional dairy to the high demand organic dairy.
I do sit on the Ag Committee, and I think we've heard beginning farmer programs and the transition bridge. I know there's the federal side of it, but I'm not sure at the state level. It might be, you know, our jurisdiction with this committee is more the Board of Soil and Water Resources rather than agricultural finance or agricultural policy. But we do have a lot of cross-pollination on the committee and folks who are here. So I think this is a good thing that we can bring up, because it's all tied together, mm-hmm. production and conservation. And so I think we can check on that.
Representative Wagenius, I serve as the vice chair of the Agriculture Committee in the House, and there were several initiatives that came forward this year. Some of those were included and funded in the Ag Special Bill, which was in higher education, and then there are also some initiatives that were funded in the Agriculture Bill as well. But I can talk to you more about that later if you want.
I had a question about one of your slides with the house on the bluff,
mm-hmm.
and just you know, where does the zoning responsibility lie there? Does it lie with the county or with the township or with the city, or?
It varies depending on the site. That particular site was a rural zoning issue, township. Those are going to be generally county and township.
As a follow-up, do the counties have ordinances for blufflands with slope maybe preventing housing?
I think it's going to vary county by county. If
you could state your name for the.
Rudy Spitzer. Along with being on the Soil and Water Board, I'm also on the Winona County Planning and Zoning Board. And there is, I think, four or five townships that have their own zoning, and there's the rest of them are handled by the county, except for in the cities of, in the bigger cities, like St. Charles and Winona. Other than that, and there is an ordinance about, we do have an ordinance against building on such slopes and stuff. But there again, it's not enforced very good either, and a lot of them will go ahead and build on a steep slope like that and pay a $500 fine or whatever and get fined. In bluffland areas, as defined by the state's shoreland rules, there are provisions that apply to development on steep slopes if they're within 1,000 feet of lake or 300 feet of the river. If it's a steep slope outside of those areas, there's no state standard that says you have to avoid them. So it's a matter of local ordinance drafting, and I would guess that not all communities have, including Homestead County and Rochester, have thoroughly addressed the issue of slope as a type of natural hazard.
Okay. I do want to encourage, I turned my cell phone off. I would encourage if Representative Gunther has his off now, and if folks could turn off their cell phone, and we'll proceed with the presentation. Proceed.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning.
CWP is a nonprofit organization formed in early 2005. Mission statement is to promote protection and improvement of the Zumba River watershed. When you consider all the lands that drain to either the Zumba River or any of its tributaries, we have a number that's just shy of 1 million acres. It covers sections or portions of six different counties of southeast Minnesota. So we have a big job and we consider it pretty important. But equally important is our role as stakeholder in the greater southeast Minnesota region. So with that, I'm going to present the next few slides. Now, Linda was talking about the susceptibility of erosion and sedimentation in southeast Minnesota, and it is a problem. There has been estimates in southeast Minnesota that up to 40% of the streams do not have any riparian buffer at all. That varies from west to east side of the region. But 40% overall is a pretty big number. That's no protection. So there is definitely a need for riparian buffers. But what's being done to establish shoreline buffers? Well, shoreline buffers, they're not new. They've been around for quite a while. Some of the big thing that comes to mind for me right away is USDA Farm Bill programs. Those have been around for a long time. They offer a lot of program options, federally funded, sometimes you can blend that with state funding or local funding to increase the options for agricultural producers. It's generally well accepted by the agricultural community as well. For several reasons. Actually, it's very easy to find the offices, one-stop shop kind of thing, and you get land payments. And it's a voluntary program, which is a really nice way to be able to do things voluntarily. But there are also problems with that approach, too. Some of the problems are just the restrictions in being able to enroll in the programs. Sometimes cropping history does become a problem for enrollment, and more often than you would expect. Some landowners don't want to tie up their land in a long-term contract, so that's another barrier. And the payments that they get for the set-aside programs are really being outcompeted by huge land values just skyrocketing. And also commodity markets fluctuating a lot. So they're not always willing to take the risk to put that land in a set-aside program. The flip side of the voluntary approach is, of course, the regulations, the ordinances, which oftentimes comes down to the county level. compliance enforcement is sometimes an effective method when you don't get the volunteer effects that you want. There was a survey done in 2006 of the county planning and zoning in the southeast Minnesota counties. And there was three things that came up in respect to just the buffers and enforcing the buffer laws that exist right now. Lack of knowledge of this, of these ordinances, of these rules was one of them, or understanding of what these standards are. Lack of funds for staff and resources, that's a big one. And as far as the buffer compliance goes, there are no compliance triggers the way that they have for other things, such as building permits, selling the land. These things aren't established for checking compliance of buffers. It's a fairly new idea for counties to be out doing the compliance on buffer laws. Buffer initiative efforts. Buffer initiative came of that DNR requirement, the DNR requirement that shoreland that's in an agricultural land use that is not under an approved conservation plan must have a 50-foot buffer of vegetation. Grant County was able to show us that when you put a concentrated effort, a multi-level effort, you can achieve great results in landowner compliance with a concentrated, focused effort. We would like to replicate that, not only in the Zumbro watershed, but all over southeast Minnesota. And with that came the Shoreland Initiative, which has been an ordinance adopted by all but one of the counties in southeast Minnesota. This ordinance, adoption ordinance by the counties, is showing commitment from each county to do landowner education, to educate staff, and to improve landowner compliance to the buffer rules. But as you know, adopting ordinance is the first step. That's the plan. To take it to success, you need to implement that. What are the barriers to implementing this? Again, it comes back to the funding. All good efforts require the attention of skilled and attentive staff. They need the funding. One option to increase funding is to increase natural resource block grants that can then go to the counties so that they have the money to do the staff training or to get new staff to bring that knowledge base up of these ordinances. Oh, yeah, and another option in that is to provide the funding as a performance base. And that way, each county is responsible for their own actions rather than just as simple grants. One other topic I want to cover here is the impaired waters in TMDL. And that was mentioned a little bit earlier, and I don't want to go too deep into this. But it is important. I have a couple things to say. Turbidity impairments exist on nearly all the waters that are assessed for this impairment. Basically, as water is being assessed for the turbidity impairment, it's found to be impaired. And that's a trend that we see over and over again. We expect to see that to continue as more waters are assessed for this turbidity impairment. Currently, in southeast Minnesota, there are 72 turbidity impaired waters. This map up here shows you just the boundary of the Zumbro River watershed. Of the 72, we have 13 of them. I don't know if you can quite see on the map there, but there's little blue lines in there that indicate stretches of stream that don't have any listed impairments, and that's mainly because they haven't been assessed yet. So we would expect that as those waters are assessed, they're going to join the list. The other colors on there, including the dark gray, show you what waters are currently on the impaired waters list. Now, the Zumbro watershed is really fortunate that starting this year, we received funding to do a TMDL turbidity study. I'm really excited about that because that TMDL study is going to really do a comprehensive look at where our problems are coming from. But this is just us, just the Zumbro watershed. We know we're lucky because we know the waiting list for funding is long. We know a lot of people need these TMDL studies. And even after the TMDL study is done, comes the implementation portion of the TMDL study. And those need funding as well. So perhaps increase in the natural resources block grant can assist with that as well. With that kind of thought, I'm going to turn it over to Phil.
Representative Gunther has a question.
Thank you. You had a good presentation. Appreciate it. We have a lot of lakes in my community, Martin County. We have five that go through the city limits. And in order to keep our water less turbid and keep the sediment from filling our lakes, what we did with every creek that goes into our lake, and we don't have a million acre watershed, so. Yeah. But we put in scupper dams and filtering strips, and they have helped water clarity and reduced turbidity a lot, as well as the fact that over the last 25 years we have been dredging our lakes. We got them down to 26 feet deep. They were only 12 feet deep at one time. And it's a lot of local effort. In fact, our liquor store profits paid for that for the last 20 years. And we just sold our dredge to Emmitsburg, Iowa, that put it in the lake right by their casino. But it really is amazing what we could get done with the liquor store profits, a little bit of sweat equity, in building scupper dams and filtering strips, really do a tremendous job. So I know we don't have a million acres, and you do. But you could start a little bit at a time, and really that would pay off tremendously, in my opinion. And I would be very open to personally helping fund some of that.
Oh, thank you. It's good to hear your personal testimony and a partnership approach.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
As I said, my name is Phil Wheeler. I'm the planning director for the Rochester Wellsville Planning Department. I just have a little bit about flood and what basically has related to the kind of intense storm we saw back in August. These three pictures on this slide, the one in the left top is the senior citizen complex in St. Charles, a relatively new facility that was built in accordance with the floodplain management program. The light that's on in the car that's in the background there is that car was driven onto the site by an emergency responder, and the water rose fast enough that he was unable to get out by the vehicle he drove in on. That's evidence that we need improved early warning. The people in that complex had a half hour between the time the warning was given and the time they had to be evacuated. On the right is most of the flooding that we had in some of our cities. Eota, for example, was subsurface flooding either from sewage backup or from groundwater flow through the walls. And we needed to identify sites susceptible to that better. The picture on the bottom is the back wall of back window of one of the rooms at the historic Ronald McDonald House in Rochester. That's a massive slope failure costing about $500,000 worth of damage. That relates to building on sites that have significant differences in elevation and addressing the issues that are related to that. But in general, we need to do a better job of identifying sites at high risk of landslides, this being one of them, possibly the result of human interference. But we have other sites throughout the county in southeastern Minnesota that are characterized by thin soils. We're in a karst region with thin soils over steep slopes with sandstone or shale bedrock. And once that soil is saturated, it becomes lubricated and readily slippable. We should be able to identify where those slides have happened in prehistory and recent history and regulate better construction in those areas. All of this is made more important by the fact that we seem to have an increased intensity of frequency of intense storms from the time when our base data on flooding was created. And all of it would be facilitated by better natural resource information generated by what's called LIDAR, which are in the next four or five slides. If we can model terrain better, we can match it up with things like the Doppler radar rainfall totals and have more instantaneous assessments of the runoff characteristics and the likely hydraulic constraints of stream channels and be able to predict much more rapidly where flooding will take place. But we need better data to do that. Here's an example of the type of data that we now have readily available. That's 30-meter elevation data from USGS. And if you got back far enough and squinted your eyes, that would look like a topo map. Made it small enough to do that. That's the sort of topo map that is generated from. That's a 10-foot contour interval. And for the same site, here is LIDAR data. LIDAR is created by pulsing lasers like from airplanes 5,000 times per minute and gives you 6-inch or better accuracy. That's that same site that you just saw with improved imagery. And that's the 2-foot contour map that can be generated from this LIDAR technology. LIDAR technology has been around since the 80s. And it was a military application initially. Some counties have purchased that. Most of our counties locally have not. I'm one of those who have proposed it and have gotten approval through our county levy. So support for this sort of thing on a county-wide basis, or region-wide basis, would be extraordinarily beneficial. It would enable us much more precisely to indicate areas where we have that combination of shallow soils, steep slopes, underlying sandstone or channel bedrock, and therefore a risk of slope failure. It would also enable us to identify where the constraints in the channels are such that we'll have rapid increases in flood elevations. And I think I will now turn it over to...
Oh, we had one question.
I appreciate you coming to testify, Phil. And I have one question here, and if you can be as brief as possible, because we could talk about this for quite a while. But were you at all involved in the mitigation dollars that you put the application out for after the flood had occurred here, or after we got the torrential rains? And is something like LIDAR, would that qualify for the mitigation dollars from FEMA? As we look forward, because it seems like you could do a substantial amount of planning with a technology like that. But
yeah.
Did you ask at all during that process if that
we
would
did.
Qualify?
Olmsted County did, at least, and I believe the region, other parts of the region included that. The more land area you get covered by aerial photography with this LIDAR technology, the cheaper it is.
Right.
So to do all of Olmsted County costs about half as much per acre as doing just the stream channels that, for example, that as part of our expansion of the floodplain mapping project. So we included it for Olmsted County. I hope that other counties included it. I know B. Hoffman of the southeast of Minnesota, whatever. Has also been looking at a regional approach to acquiring LIDAR data.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Commissioner.
Thank you. I'm Judy Oley, and I'm a director of the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. I'm also on the South Zumbro Watershed Joint Powers Board. I'm a director of the Southeast Minnesota Waters Joint Powers Board. I'm an officer of the Whitewater Watershed Joint Powers Board. I'm on the Olmsted County Environmental Commission, and I'm also an Olmsted County Commissioner. So I have a lot of titles, very little technical ability, but I get around. And I have to tell you that the collaboration that we have in southeastern Minnesota and the partnerships are just amazing. And we really rely on grants to do a lot of the good work that we do in southeastern Minnesota. We rely on and need direct funding and permanent funding for some of the things that we're doing. And we hope that you keep that in your consideration during the next legislative session. And I want to give you an example of that. Southeastern Minnesota has over 120 unsewered areas. Now, developing and implementing the most cost-effective solutions is extremely complex and demanding. Since 2002, in response to the regional fecal coliform TMDL, the Southeast Minnesota Water Resource Board and the Cannon River Watershed Partnership have developed a team approach to help small communities address their wastewater problems. It requires two full-time community facilitators and educational assistants from the University of Minnesota. Now, it takes communities between 6 to 10 years to go through the process, even with all this technical assistance. Yet, the effort is supported with three-year grants. So you can see where the disconnect is there. What's needed is full-time funding for these positions until we make all the changes that we need in these unsewered areas. We have listed all the challenges today that we're faced in southeastern Minnesota, and I have to tell you, I try to, even though I'm not an official member of the Basin Alliance for the Lower Mississippi, I try to go to all those meetings because they always have between 15 and 20 partners, agency folks, that attend that meeting. And we are truly all partners and collaborators of what happens in southeastern Minnesota. And we're really hoping that we get that collaboration from the state. And obviously you're hearing and you are caring and wanting to help with what happens in our area. But we do have some solutions too. The solutions that we have listed are to promote shoreline buffers and upland storage, to support that LIDAR to improve land and water management, and to make long-term commitments supporting local water management programs. And with your help, we can really make great strides in southeastern Minnesota. So thank you very much. That concludes this portion. Next, we were going to have the Zumbro Watershed Partnership, but I think we missed Andy and George. And I think we should bring them up next.
Member from Gunther, I think, had a question.
Okay.
When you say 126 unsewered areas, can you describe what an area is?
An area, well, I'll give you an example of an area that I'm involved with, and that's the city of Orinoco. And that's directly north of Olmsted's or of Rochester. But there are little communities all over southeastern Minnesota. And there are communities that are close enough together that should have a plan put together to deal with their sewer systems.
Describe communities. One or two houses together?
Technical
or?
People.
Excuse me for just a second because we're having a hard time picking this up on the microphone. So
okay.
Make sure we speak into the microphone, and then if folks could come up to the table.
Okay.
To.
Jerry, would you help with this one?
I think in the case of communities as we're describing it, they would be clusters of homes, typically rural communities at one time. An example that Judy gave was Orinoco, which is probably the largest or one of the largest, but a more typical example might be Biola, and I don't know if you went through Biola, but it's the old creamery and a church and several, maybe a dozen houses. That would probably be the most typical unsewered community that we're dealing with.
We did notice a lot of mound systems as we travel out throughout the area. Individual septic systems, are those not adequate?
Oh, I would clarify. I think Judy was referring to the Orinoco as being an example where we'd want to see community sewer. I think in some of the smaller clusters of homes and small communities, the only feasible solution, long-term feasible solution, is probably going to be on-site systems or individual septic systems or some sort of cluster septic system. I think it's just not going to be feasible to provide community sewers to places like that.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Gunther.
A couple more questions. I think, Commissioner, you can get that Orinoco put on the sewage treatment priority list by simply calling the Minnesota Public Facilities Administration and notifying that Minnesota Pollution Control, who keeps track of where the highest priorities are of doing that, and get an individual or a community sewage treatment plant put in there. I have a town in my district that's got 130 homes or buildings. They just have one installed. So I don't think Orinoco is any smaller than that, is it?
No, it's not.
Okay,
no.
So they can certainly put it on their priority list, and it would be something that the federal and the state government fund. And I have one other suggestion for Lake Zumbro to build those filter strips and stuff. Try Sentence of Serve. You control them.
Thank you.
Mr. Hart and Mr. Polk.
My name is Andy Hart. I'm a local farmer in Olmsted County. I'm also the Olmsted County Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor. I'm also involved in the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. Kind of my title. I have a little video clip that I'd like to introduce you to the aerial seeding concept that we've been working on in the past since 2005 in southeast Minnesota. As Andy Welty had mentioned before, we're trying to get our aerial seeding or the cover crop program out. We're fortunate enough to have the local Channel 10 News do a short piece on it, and that's what we're going to watch now. That's just a little idea of what we've done with the aerial seeding concept in southeast Minnesota. That's not the only program we've promoted. On the two handles I handed out, working with Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Don Rasmussen from the Fillmore County, part of the Balm Alliance cover crop strategy team, we put together that flyer which we've been handing out at local farm events, the Agribusiness Farm Show, Farm Country Breakfast on the Farm, any opportunity we have to hand this out to farmers we have. We've been able to, in 2005, I think we started off about 300 acres. 2006, we had about 1,500 acres. Unfortunately, this last year ran into a little bit of a snag. We've been using a helicopter service that does mosquito spraying in the Twin Cities. It's worked out real well because the helicopters is set up for the seeding, and they're able to come directly from the Twin Cities, bring the helicopter down. We're able to start spreading the winter rye on this field without a lot of modifications. Unfortunately, about the time we wanted to start, that's when the rain started. And they were very busy in the Twin Cities spraying the fields. And they actually had one of the helicopters crash. We saw in the news this summer. So we weren't able to get anything seeded in southeast Minnesota this year. We were very disappointed. But that's not kind of the end of the story. There's lots of ways to get a cover crop established. You can use a grain drill. You can use a fertilizer spreader, whether it's a, what's called a spinner spreader, which has little spinners out the back and will broadcast it across the field. You can use an airflow, which is another type of spreader. Winter rye is a cover crop which I like to use because it will overwinter. It's one that is very aggressive in its growth, especially in the spring. It will grow very rapidly, faster than your lawn does. And when the spring starts to rain, everybody is worried about getting the lawn mowed. The winter rye grows very fast, and it holds the soil really well. We've done some research working with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, how much nitrates are below the cover crop versus an area of the field which has no cover crop on, and we're seeing a marked reduction in parts per million of the nitrates. The cost of this can be relatively small. This year we had the helicopter lined up. The cost is going to be in that $20 to $25 range, depending on the rate of seed that you're going to seed. If a farmer wanted to do it himself with his own grain drill, he could reduce rates to a half bushel or close to a bushel. A bushel winter rye is approximately $6 a bag. So we'd have $3 to $6 an acre in it in just this time. So you can establish a cover crop on your soils or on your fields to protect the soils for relatively low cost. The advantage of using the helicopter, as I stated in the video, is that you get it on much earlier. And the earlier you get it on, the more growth you get, the better it is for soil erosion, the better if you have livestock for grazing. Also, the more growth you get at that time of the year, the less nitrates that will eventually end up, or potentially, I should say, could end up in the groundwater. We've had a good start at this program. We've had a lot of interest by area farmers. We've worked with Linda Dahl, the Whitewater Joint Powers Board, Jennifer Rottenberg, the watershed groups. We've worked with the local soil and water conservation districts, the NRCS. As we explained all night, we've worked together as partners in this in southeast Minnesota, working on conservation. Probably the biggest thing that would continue to move this program forward is to get some type of cost-share dollars. The Whitewater Joint Powers Board had for a time cost-share dollars for farmers that would try this cover crop program. It did not have to be aerial seeding. It could be however the farmer wanted to get his cover crop on it, whether he did it with his own grain drill, called the local elevator, and had them use the spreader with the fertilizer spreader. We found $7 an acre is what the cost was at that time. Things have gone up quite a bit, but it really got the farmer's attention to try it. And there was a checks and balances there. They did the cover crop in the fall or late summer, and then they were spot check after planting. They had to have a certain amount of residue to receive the cost share payment. And as you saw a lot of the slides, and as your tour today, you saw a lot of erosion. If we had more acres covered with cover crops, we would sell a lot less. Kind of our goal is to maybe keep the ground green and growing year-round. And with cover crops, especially the winter rye, something that will overwinter, we literally can. We can keep it green and growing from the time this year's corn crop, so to speak, is drying down and ready for harvest. We can have a cover crop already growing in that field. As the field is harvested, that's green and growing all the way to this coming spring. The farmer can kill that off, reduce some tillage on it, and plant his next crop and almost literally have something on that ground green and growing year round to help protect the soil. I guess that's the end of my presentation.
Any questions? I have a couple just on helicopter. The district rents the helicopter, and then how does the money flow or contract flow?
The first year, Minnesota Department of Ag had $3,000 that they put into this project. And it did about 300 acres. They actually paid $10 an acre towards the farmer, and that was about the cost of the helicopter. At that time, fuel prices weren't quite so high. This last year, it would have been about $14 an acre for the helicopter because of the higher fuel costs. And I actually have a grant from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Energy and Sustainable Ag Program. I have a three-year grant to work on this. I'm working with the NDA and the Green Book, which I think most of you are familiar with. And unfortunately, we weren't. This would have been the second year of that grant. And I still have one more year. We're very excited about continuing on with it. We're tweaking some of the rates, some of the timing. We're actually going to try to do some of the seeding the 1st of August. And we will try to seed all the way up through Labor Day, kind of a month window. And hopefully that's soon enough that we can work around the helicopter pilot schedule. If we had more acres committed and more dollars, we probably could secure a helicopter a little bit more reliably. But because we're such limited funds, we have $3,000. And $1,000 goes for the research and the soil testing for the nitrate study. We have $2,000 left for cost share for farmers. So it's relatively small, but yet with explaining it to livestock producers, you know, they can see the win-win there. And especially this year with pastures were short and such, they were very excited about trying to get this to go.
Secondly, did you see any allelopathic effect on weed suppression with rye?
Yes, we did. Yes, it did suppress the weeds. In the spring, we recommend getting the winter rye killed early, maybe 6 to 8 inches tall, so that you don't have an effect on the next year's crop. That potentially, if you let it get too tall, you know, maybe let's say knee high, you could probably have some issues with reduced yields for that farmer the next year. But that's, you know, usually the minimum age or so. Unless you have livestock, they can kind of keep that mode down for you, and that works well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is George Polk. I'm a Olmsted County Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor. I should mention, too, that I'm also a former soil surveyor, so I've written a lot of soil surveys, you know, of this particular area. And I'm quite happy to hear the presentations of all these people because they've looked at that book and learned a lot about the soils here. So I do have that background, but I was somewhat voted in as a supervisor for the Soil and Conservation District. It was a good thing to have done. One thing that wasn't mentioned here, and I have to slight Judy just a little bit. She left out one role that she has. She's also on the Hiawatha RC&D Council, right, Judy? Yeah. One more thing that she's done, but you know, this is kind of an important organization. We actually have what we refer to now as a Driftless Area Initiative, and we're looking at a partnership of a four-state area of the whole Mississippi Valley. And the council itself, you know, is actually represented by a county commissioner, a supervisor like myself, and a person that's at large, and we do this for the 11 county areas. So it's a good organization to gather input at the federal, state, and county level. So this is something we're doing quite a bit. We're working like with dry hydrants, trails, airports, and a variety of things like that. I don't want to dwell too much on that. One of the roles I had as a supervisor here is my area of representation is both the urban area and the kind of the rural area, but the two townships I have are being rapidly urbanizing. And some of the issues I have is, you know, I've been brought up, you know, being taught, you know, well, it was then the Soil Conservation Service that you simply treat the water where it falls. And, of course, I think Andy's presentation is a classic example of what he's doing with cover crops because, you know, literally he's capturing all the water before it runs off. And I think you've heard that in all of the presentations tonight. A little bit of an issue I'm starting to have. You've heard a lot about the assessment of these riparian areas of these little floodplains. One area that's not getting too much attention is that we're having a lot of old growth of forest or invasive type trees in some of these floodplains. And of course, Andy, I think you mentioned something that was quite interesting too. You referenced the small dairy herds going out. And what is happening is that a lot of these riparian areas that could not be farmed are being covered, you know, with box elder, buckthorn, and very invasive trees. And the impact I'm seeing that these particular areas are having on the floodplain is, and Terry Lee has, you know, showed me an article done by Stan Trimble, which shows that these channels are actually widening, you know, where the stream is and eroding. And which I find quite interesting, but I'm wondering, too, if the velocity of the water is actually increasing due to some kind of a Venturi effect and really hastening our flooding. But here I think we really need, our concern I have is we need to focus on, managing these areas. If you look at the existing programs, much of the existing programs are aimed at farm lands. The EQIP program can only deal with cropland. Many of the other programs only deal with cropland too, but we're not dealing with these areas that were once pastured, like you mentioned, that once served as a temporary storage for floodplain. Now actually all the floodwaters are being sent right down the channel. I'm not a hydrologist and I wasn't trained as that, but my question is maybe we need to do a little bit more research in the effects of what our floodplain is like, from that standpoint. So that's an issue I think we need to address. I applaud what these people are trying to do, bringing the attention of managing this riparian border. But I think there are some areas that are just simply not being managed and are really affecting the flooding that we're experiencing in Elba and Stockton and these communities. All you have to do is look at an aerial photo and you'll see perhaps what it is I'm talking about. One other area that kind of concerns me, and see, I'm working with the urban community quite a bit. They're doing quite a bit also with stormwater management, but they have what I see in Rochester, they have these big wet ponds and things like that, but there's an issue of where the water should be infiltrating as opposed to where it should be stored, where wetlands can be created. Somehow we need more study in that particular area. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has done a beautiful job in preparing a manual on what kind of practices to apply, but working at it from a soils and geological perspective, it's a question of what works where, and somehow we need to get to that point in our discussion too with these type of practices. But this is kind of the extent of what I have to present coming out of it from a soil surveyor. Dealing it with a supervisor level has been a real challenge for me. But any comments or questions, I can address them.
We did in this past legislative session, and maybe Mr. Jashke will talk about this later, we put some money in for invasive species control and also set up an arrangement formally with the Minnesota Conservation Corps and the Board of Water and Soil Resources for dealing with these things, and then also a county, looking like a county cooperative for invasive species control. So we've recognized and tried to start on this path that, and certainly when we were driving around looking at the buckthorn, it's everywhere, but also just the box elders along the streams, and then you look at the magnificent oaks that are around, but then you have the box elders coming all over the place as well. So I think we're starting to take some action there, and we view a lot of that as kind of the first step, and we want to see how they work. And at the local districts, we give the money, we give the authority to Bowser, and you can pass it to the districts, and for you and the districts as local supervisors to take it and run with it and to implement it. And so I think Mr. Jashke will talk a little bit later about that.
We have Dean Albertson from Lake Zumba would like to speak to you a little bit here.
Mr. Albertson.
I'm Dean Albertson, and I represent the Lake Zumbro Improvement Association. And for members in the legislature, you might remember us last January, we walked around with blue and white Lake Zumbro Forever caps. And we had about 50 people up at the state capitol, and we met with 100 senators and representatives. 2.5 years ago, I was appointed chairman of the restoration committee. It had been called a dredging committee until I met the first night, and I couldn't chair a dredging committee. They said I need to chair a restoration committee, and they understood that. And we really had two things in mind when we formed this committee 2.5 years ago. One, we knew that upstream and all of the streams coming into the river were affecting our lake. There was no question about it. Number two, we knew we had about 1 million to 1.5 million cubic yards of sediment that's accumulated since 1919. And we had those two issues to address. And we want to do both at the same time. That's why we're working closely with the partnership. That's why we're working with all the regional people that we can get. And that's why we're also saying, though, it's a big bill to dredge 1.5 million or 1 million cubic yards of sediment. That, by the way, that's 100,000 truckloads of sediment if you had to haul it out. And so we, last year, put in for $350,000 worth of planning money in the bonding cycle. That was on the governor's desk and died with all the rest. We now know that is true, and we're back again. We're asking for $350,000 again in the 08 session in the bonding cycle for planning money. And that planning money would go to find a way to remove this 1 million-some cubic yards of sediment and place it around the lake in strategic spots. Our intention is to come back in the 2010 session and ask for money to do that and in the bonding cycle. And people involved in this and groups involved in this will be Olmsted County, Wabasha County, Rochester Public Utilities, who happen to own all the land underneath the lake and the dam. They will be heavily involved. The lake, people around the lake, and people that use the lake within 15, 20 miles of us. I grew up in Detroit Lakes, near Detroit Lakes. There is no regional lake, they're all lakes. There's 20 lakes within 20 miles of Detroit Lakes, and they're all fairly clean. In this region, there aren't any. Lake Zumbro is a river with a dam on the end of it, and it needs to be fixed because we don't have other lakes here. And that's why we're requesting what we're requesting. And that's why we're going to go after it again this year. You're going to see us again at the Capitol. You're going to see us walking around talking, and we're going to do whatever we can to make sure we clean up this valuable resource. And we expect to do a great deal of planning with that money and come up with the best plan to do it in 2010. Where will the money come from? We're hoping to get between 5 and 6 million out of the state funding through bonding. We expect to get money from the counties. We expect to get money from the lake owners. And we expect money to get from RPU and special projects. We expect to come up with a total of about $10 million when we're done. What does that have to do with what we heard tonight? A great deal. It's what this sediment is doing at the end of the road. It's coming into this body of water. We have gone from 5.9 billion gallons of water to 3.2 billion gallons of water during that time period from 1919 till now. We've lost nearly 50% of the water supply. RPU is very enthused about making sure we keep the dam at the end of this river, and they want to continue getting electricity off of the river. And they're supporting this project with a great deal of zeal. And with people like Judy Oley, who has helped in the very beginning to get the watershed off the ground, and Lake Zumbro pushing that issue, we are in total agreement that this is a great thing to do. And we will do whatever it takes to help with the upstream and the up area projects and the problems with that. And I've heard many, many good suggestions tonight. And by May of 2010, I want to hear the sucking sound of a tube about this size sucking mud out of Lake Zumbro and deposited around the lake in very carefully selected sites. And then I am going to take a long, long rest after that. Any questions?
for some beginnings.
No question, but a comment. I'm glad to hear you say that you'll do anything it takes upstream.
Upstream, there's no question about it.
Because that is going to be the best sales pitch you can make, for one, because the notion of having to repeat is just not one that's appealing. And I think we are faced with that in all sorts of situations where Austin dikes, they need dikes, but we have to figure out what we can do upstream. How about upstream? The dikes aren't going to work.
One of the things we did do is that we formed a non-profit organization, Lake Zumbro Forever. And that's made up of 12 board of director members. And that group will be committed to maintain this project when it's done. So we will then find a way to maintain the system in the fact that there will be runoff. The big plus for us is that between 1919 and 1957, that was the biggest amount of sediment possible. That was a huge amount that came in. And ever since then, it's been less and less and less. But it's still coming in, but dramatically less than in 1957 and before. And so that's the optimistic side of things. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate. I looked at your schedule, by the way, a few minutes ago, and I know how early you got up this morning. And I know where you've been. I know you've been in Austin. I know you've been all over the place. And you know what? We had 19 senators at Lake Zumbro about 2 weeks ago. And they had a horrendous schedule. And they sat on two pontoons and looked at our situation, because they're going to consider that bonding issue again in February. But they made probably 7 or 8 contacts that day, all of them demanding their attention. And I really appreciate all of you doing this. Any other questions?
Thank you. I know we have a couple other folks who've signed up, and then I do want to make sure that people do have the opportunity to speak if they haven't signed up. I know Mr. Terrell, Mr. Spitzer, and Mr. Kuhl. So, Rudy.
I'm Rudy Spitzer. I'm chairman of the Soil and Water Board in Winona County, and I'm also the area 7 director, which is an area that you folks all toured most of the time today, I think, the way it looked to me, according to your schedule. I'd just like to say that as part of my duty as Area 7 director, I sit on the state board, and our state convention is coming up in the first week in December, and I would like to invite you to come to our December 4th meeting. There's a area awards banquet and awards presentation, and they will have slides there of the good work that people are doing around the whole state, and it's very interesting. If I'd just like to invite you to come if you possibly can make it. It starts at 12 and it runs till 2 o'clock. That's just a portion of our convention, but a very important part. I served on the awards committee this year for the first time, and that was a real challenge. I said every one of them that was submitted was a winner, but we had to pick one out of there, and it was a challenge. That's
and you, and you can't tell us who it is right now.
No, we can't do that. Next is Tim Terrell.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Tim Terrell from the Winona, representing the Winona Soil and Water Conservation District. Rudy is my chair supervisor. And I also want to start out a thank you to all of you, not just for coming, but for something that took a lot of leadership in 2003. Obviously, that wasn't the brightest and best year for most state budgets. But during that year, the General Services Grant, which comes directly to Soil and Water Conservation Districts, That was not cut. You actually maintained the level of funding. So I want to, first of all, give an appreciation and give recognition where recognition is due. Just to give you a little bit of history about Winona, and I'm kind of, when I talk about Winona, a lot of things are general to SWCDs, especially the Southeast Soil and Water Conservation Districts. The history, Winona was the first, had the first district in Minnesota and the second in the nation. So we were like the founding fathers of conservation. When you hear about some of these things like cover crops, structures being built, they learned it here in Southeast Minnesota. We started this thing going on, and look where we're at now. But this, we were basically set up by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a grassroots organization to solve soil erosion problems on private lands. Of course, now we were talking in that time in the 1938 about the Dust Bowl era. Since then, we've expanded that role to more water quality, which is encompassing soil erosion, but also water quality, nitrate removal, things along that way, and restoration. Did you know that 78% of the land in Minnesota is privately owned? We're not going to run out of land. We've got definitely a big job to do. But some people might ask, well, what do we do here? Well, we do wellhead protection planning, but that's not our primary job. We do a Wetland Conservation Act and enforce that, but that's not our primary job. Our primary job is to promote conservation and provide technical assistance to landowners and preserve and restore the water quality to private lands. That's what we get doing, and we do that by doing practices. And one of the things that we do is we implement the programs that lawmakers create. So whatever program you want to create at the state office, this is where it hits the ground. We have the contact with the people, with the farmers, with the landowners in our counties, and we know them by name. And we go out there and we talk to them about these programs and we sell them these conservation programs. However, what happens in one county, as you can see, because of geography and geographics and geomorphology, can be completely different three counties away. So giving broad programs from your level helps us tailor it to fit our counties. So how do we do that? Well, we partner with federal agencies like the Natural Resources Conservation Service to match federal dollars with state dollars. How well did we do? Well, in 2007, not including flood money, Winona County leveraged $4.2 million federal dollars to $863,000 state dollars. So we did a heck of a lot of leveraging in Winona County here, just from general CRP, Conservation Reserve Program, EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and we sell a lot of conservation in Winona County. And why do we do that? Well, we have a good working relationship with NRCS, and that's a really good key right there. So what are some of the issues that are facing SWCDs as I talk today? And I kind of get the privilege of talking about the administrative part of it because I am a district manager. But some of the things that we deal with is the general service grant. The good part about it is flexible and used to support those technical and operational needs, but it doesn't even meet 25% of our operational budget as a soil and water conservation district. Now, that starts the first domino in the domino effect, because the next point is not all the programs from the state have technical and administration attached to them. For instance, 20% cost share to implement these programs. Now, has anybody heard of Leonid Hurwitz? Did anybody hear of him? You know who he is? He's a professor at the University of Minnesota who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And one of the things he stressed was the importance for individual incentives. If we're not being supported by some of these things, we need to go after other grants, which we are doing, and we are doing them. However, that starts the incentive starts controversy, because in the final analysis, because we lack funding to support SWCs, we have to go even private to look for private grants and also state grants, which they compete against themselves instead of a level and equal promotion of programs to help your constituents. What does that mean? Well, from a very concrete perspective, let's say we have a feedlot program that gives us 20% cost share, and we have a RIM conservation easement program that will permanently put land away out of production and permanently protect the water quality. We got to think about surviving now, year to year, and we still want to do it. So there's a little shift. However, just because there's a shift in the administration there and not maybe parallel doesn't mean that necessarily affects us. Last year, we put over 800 acres into the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, 800 acres. That's quite a bit. And another thing is with the feedlot, over 75% of the feedlots in Winona County were funded by the feedlot cost share program. Representative Bob Gunther talked about how can we deal with the water quality. He asked that question from feedlots. The answer is keep funding the feedlot cost share program because, like I said, in Winona County, we can sell that, but maybe three counties over, it's not. But as the legislature, you had feedlot counties is what you called them, and that's the best way. Look at the county that sold CREP the most and say, if we give a little bit to some of these counties who sold the CREP, we don't have to give it to the whole state, just give it to the ones who did the best, and then we can still reap the 3-to-4-to-1 ratio of federal dollars still coming in, and we can still gain that benefit rather than relying now on RIM, which is completely state money. Another thing is, from a national perspective, I can get funding to build almost any conservation project you want, but when it comes to getting technical assistance to sell and design and implement those projects, there's very few grants available out there, very few. So solutions, as we talk about some of these things, well, obviously we've talked about if you want to go with grant, increase the general service grant. That's one of the biggest things. But, you know, just thinking long-term, things have been thrown around the legislature about as far as dedicated funding, power for SWCDs to levy, let's shift from grants to more programmatic funding for SWCDs. These are all just kind of brainstorm ideas that we look at our level and working with the existing system. But as you can see at Southeast Minnesota, we're pretty well organized. I mean, we all know each other here, and we're working as a unit. And whether you're a watershed district, an SWCD, or a lake association, you've heard a common thing, technical assistance and need for some type of funding. So we work harmoniously together to get our issues to you through the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation District, through the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and through BALM, the Basin Alliance. And we're really well organized, and we'll use different avenues to talk to different people. But one thing just to kind of wrap up, I mean, people were talking more about projects and technical things. And one of the things that we think we're going to see a lot more native grasses being grown in Winona County, because we have a biofuel project in Winona County. Pork and Plants Nursery, I met the guy and I talked to him, and he's going to convert his 100 acres into native grasses and forbs, and he's going to burn that to heat his greenhouses. And he's already got other farmers saying, I'm going to set 40 acres aside, and I'm going to do that so you can pelletize those for me so I can burn in my corn stove because my corn pellets are now too expensive to buy. And then the future is he's looking at corporate, maybe working with Olmsted Waste to Energy, and now once you have native grasses in a pelletized form, easy to transport, easy to bring to Olmsted County and burn as these plants have to be 25% renewable by 2025. We think in the future we're going to be a model for others, and we hope history repeats itself, that we're able to lead once again the state in some of these issues. So that's just some of the things I have to say. Did anybody have any questions?
No, I think you covered it well. Mr. Kuehl. There is a sign-up sheet in the back if anyone else wants to address the group. We do have some time on the agenda for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mr. Jashke has been driving us around today, and I think he also has been preparing his presentation. Maybe if John wants to come forward. And as he's doing that, I did want to comment just because dedicated funding was mentioned, and Representative Osment and I were at an event last night, and dedicated funding was talked about quite a bit. And you know, the constitutional amendment, I think that leadership in both houses is committed to bring that to the legislative session very quickly in the session. The constitutional amendment should be on the ballot next year. The way that is written, it talks about drinking water protection, talks about enhancing our resources
And but the way it's written now, it's not just one agency. The money doesn't all go to Department of Natural Resources. The way it's written is silent as to where the money comes. So the money would come into the legislature and get divided up between the various agencies and appropriated through the process where hearings like this could come and people could make their case. And so at least if I'm still here, which I hope to be, that I think the Board of Water and Sewer Resources, it's that when dedicated funding comes, it's not just the Department of Natural Resources or just the Pollution Control Agency. It's the Board of Water and Sewer Resources as well and other agencies. And so I just want to make that commitment from my perspective. And with that, after I just said Mr. Jash is going to get more money, I might
go home right now.
Mr. Jash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. John Jass, Executive Director of Water, Water and Soil Resources. It's really rewarding to go on a tour and see the real practices and problems we have out there in the landscape, but even more so to come here tonight and listen to the people from the counties, from the soil and water conservation districts, from the watershed organizations, and from the private sector who are all enthused about doing better on conservation and clean water efforts. And I'm especially happy to hear the officials, the elected and appointed officials who are sometimes maybe not always engaged in all the details, really here tonight, saying that they are and they really care. That's important to hear it right from the top, that those organizations support doing these projects, these needs that are out there are going to get met somehow, and they're going to take care of it one way or another. It's hard work, and it's always too slow. You know, we always got to wait for more data, and we got to wait for a landowner to agree to actually help us work on a project, and then we got to wait for the money to come. I mean, we'll talk about that, but their persistence and their efforts are certainly notable, and in the end, it's rewarding. I think others have said it. I'm still new enough to the job that I know what it's like to work in a local government. I worked in Dakota County before I came to the state, and those partnerships are what make it work, and if they're there, things happen. If they're not, they don't, and I see many of them here, and even from afar, I know that this part of the state has been always acknowledged as having been out in front in that area, so that's evident here, but obviously they still got some things to work on. I want to acknowledge two of our staff, Mary Kells. Mary, please stand up. Mary is our Rochester office. She's coordinating our Southeast flood response efforts, too. So Mary's been very much out front in that, and we appreciate that. And Kevin Lyons is here. He's the other bus driver. Kevin. Kevin's our conservation easements manager out of St. Paul. And, you know, well, we aren't home yet, but Kevin is the one who handles all of our conservation easements and working with our soil and water conservation districts principally across the state, so glad they could be here. Could be a lot to talk about. We aren't going to talk about everything, certainly. The things I'm not going to talk about are some of the things that were raised a little bit already, but there's always efforts being put in place regarding bioenergy and how we use some of the natural landscape to potentially be ready for that when it comes. So we're not going to talk about wetland regulations unless someone raises it. We get a lot of those questions on a daily basis. We'll have a chance to talk about administrative penalty orders tomorrow at a hearing, so we'll do that there. And I hadn't planned to talk about Clean Water Legacy either because that's a program that has been mentioned earlier, but I wanted to talk about four things, and they are the Southeast flood response. We saw some of those consequences and needs for that part of the state and the follow-up on the special session that occurred earlier this year. I wanted to also talk about a little bit on oversight. There's some new legislation and responsibilities we have to make sure that our local governments who are doing this work are ready, willing, and able. And certainly those that are here tonight seem to be, and I think that's a good thing, but we want to make sure everyone's in that status. And then also talk about drainage systems a little bit. We saw a couple of examples today, and there's some new legislation and some new money that are been put forward to look at our drainage infrastructure across the state, and a lot of that is in this part of Minnesota. And finally, just talk about how our federal and state programs coordinate in getting conservation done, both looking back a little bit and looking forward to some opportunities in the new farm bill and upcoming legislation. So that's my summary. And with that, I'll begin. I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'm using pieces of paper that are hopefully in front of you.
Does the audience have the paper? I think copies are
Yeah,
there.
I brought some quick reactors, so there's hopefully enough over there on the table. If you don't have one, I can get them to you after the meeting. The first thing I want to talk about is the Southeast flood response. In the documentation, there is basically Mary Kells' work. She has been working with a whole number of different organizations, principally our soil and water conservation districts. There was $3 million of cost share money, which is conservation cost share dollars that are used to fix problems. Stream bank erosion is principally the thing that they've been focusing on, from what I understand. Some other projects that have had flood damages that need to be repaired. Some of the impoundments that I understand were also damaged, particularly down in Houston County. You can see on this sheet there's a summary of the amounts that the Board of Water and Soil Resources allocated initially to the seven soil and water conservation districts that were in the flood disaster area. The remaining money, $2.4 million, will go through and is going through the Minnesota Recovers Task Force process, where projects are proposed and then reviewed and then ultimately allocated through that process in a coordinated fashion by the agencies. And someone asked about the LIDAR project, whether that had been submitted, and it sounds like it has been. I don't know what the conclusion is on that. I can tell you that in Dakota County, when I was there, we did accomplish a LIDAR imagery effort, and it's very, very valuable data. It actually saved us time because we didn't have to send staff people in the field to do zoning decisions. They could actually do measurements right on their screen for distance and setbacks and things like that. So it actually saved us money in terms of staff time and travel. So one small example. The other appropriation was for $1 million of conservation easement funds to go out and work with landowners to acquire lands that have been flood damaged and really ought to be retired, and try and find ways to both get them under easement and then put in the vegetation that would keep them in a permanent native vegetation status. The board also approved a redirect of $1.1 million from the prior appropriation to this same program, and that has begun as of November 2nd, I believe. They started officially working with landowners. The payment rates are established, and there'll be a sign-up period through January of 2008. One of the things that we're still needing to spend some time on, which has some tails, is once we get these projects identified, it was brought up earlier, the technical assistance to design them and then oversee construction. That takes a little longer than we like, especially when we have the winter season facing us. We won't be able to do work over the winter period. We may be back before this committee asking for an extension or maybe some additional funding for that area, so expect to hear more about that. And then finally, there was a meeting convened in the Government Brook area, which is from Minnesota City, Rolling Stone, and Stockton area. There was work done back in the 50s, believe it or not, by the federal government to identify some flood protection measures, which some planning was done, but nothing was ever actually accomplished. And so now they're obviously rethinking about how to go about that, and there will be some action I'm expecting to come from a planning effort that the federal government will sponsor, and then we'll have many of these local organizations party to that. So more to come on that. So with that, I will quickly summarize the Southeast flood response. Certainly we're hoping people are getting the relief that they're entitled to and expecting, and if not, we want to hear about it as soon as we possibly can, because we get help to them. So,
any questions from members? Mr. Jashke, I think we had, when we were on the tour in Houston County, we looked at a project that had gone in 3 years ago and had helped reduce the flood damage, but had been breached because of the volume that was there, and that the money that had come through the special session was used for that project to get that repaired. And that's exactly the type of thing when we were talking about getting money out there and why the amount of money that's been provided through the board to the Board of Water and Soil Resources was to get things fixed this fall to prevent problems with when continuing fall rains, mm-hmm. and snow coming and the spring runoff.
So that type of project was exactly the type of thing we wanted to see happen. Mm-hmm. And my only concern is we have $650,000 that's been applied for the fall. Mm-hmm. That if there were projects that could have been fixed, you know, that if the $2.4 million that's out there, I don't want to have process slow down repair to prevent future problems. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's been good to get those projects out there. That was the type, and I think other members who were on the tour would agree that's exactly the type of thing that we wanted to see happen. So maybe if you can address that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, you know, one of the, when we go into these situations that we haven't been through before, you know, we're trying to do the best we can. I think the balancing act is making sure that we get the money to the places that need it as quickly as we possibly can, especially given the circumstances we're facing with fall. We want to be prepared for spring runoff. We also want to make sure we don't miss opportunities to leverage federal money with the state money, and that's another factor that we have to bring into the equation. And then as well as having some process in place to be equitable about that, because we are likely to know that this is not the total amount of money that's needed. So that's what the Minnesota Recovers process was for, to give folks who weren't sure about how the government agencies all are supposed to be working through their programs a way to tap into a process that would help them with that. But we did, as a board, make a decision to get that initial allocation out, and hopefully that's being helpful. I understand there's more needs. We need to hear them about it as soon as we can, because that Recovers Task Force meets every week, and they will address the urgent needs first. So.
Okay, continue.
My second point I want to cover was just a little bit about this oversight responsibility that we've been asked to undertake or directed to undertake. What it entails is simply being more systematic about assuring that our local governments are performing the way they're expected to perform and managing the programs and the state dollars that come to them. We've done a couple of things. One, we've established some principles for that we're going to be systematic, that we're going to do it in a way that's going to be not necessarily critical, but also helpful. It's a performance assessment to try and make sure that things that are going well keep going well, the things that aren't going well get better. That's as simple as it is. We've hired a coordinator. We have some one-time money that we're going to use to hire that person. He's already on board. It's the first hire we've made this year, and that person is already developing a program in conjunction with our local governments, and it's looking like we're going to begin the process of actually conducting the assessments probably beginning early in 2008. So, and then that information will be reviewed and ultimately made available for the public to look at if they so choose to. So that's just beginning, but I want to let you know that there is the new statutes put in place some consequences if performance doesn't improve, primarily funding consequences. And so some of the folks also here mentioned that they're supportive of the idea of, you know, basically rewarding good performance through grant and other state funding. So much of that will likely come to pass through that process. So I'll just leave it at that and give you more updated information as we get further along in the process. Again, the third thing was the drainage. We didn't hear much about that tonight from other testifiers, but drainage systems. One might ask, well, what's the difference between a ditch and a stream? You know, I don't know if there's really a good definition. Some people think a ditch is the conduit that removes water, and some think that a stream is the conduit that receives it, right? The real difference is simply that the ditches are managed and regulated under a different statute, 103E, and the streams are managed under a statute 103G. Now, that may seem like a small difference, one letter, but reality is that they are managed quite differently. But on the landscape, they're very much the same. They're the systems that move our water from one place to another. We saw earlier today, we stopped actually for the lunch stop. It was at Moscow Township, and we were very near a big channel that was known as Judicial Ditch 24, and if you go across the section line, it becomes Turtle Creek. You wouldn't know the difference if it looked this way or that way, but it's certainly the same water. It's the same pollutants in the water, the same plant and animal communities in the water. It's the same, you know, watershed, the same ultimate destination, but we do manage those systems differently for good reasons, too. And we also saw in the Hollandale area the need that community and the area around it relies on for drainage to make their their land productive and keep their community dry enough to sustain itself. So with that said, there were some changes made in the law, and they relate primarily to the buffer issue, which has been one that's been challenging for a long, long time. We heard from the Freeborn County staff or the elected official there who manages the system that, you know, they're going through a systematic approach to make sure everyone who is part of a system is paying their fair share, and in doing so, they also require this one-rod buffer strip to be installed, and they're also trying to, as some of the other presenters talked about, leverage federal programs to tell landowners, take advantage of this, because if you do it right, you can get your buffer area under a federal or state program that will help you get some resources to pay for that. So much more attention being paid to that, and the idea of the shoreland zoning provision, that's one more distinction between ditches and non-ditches, right? The shoreland zoning standard applies to streams, but it does not apply to ditches. That's the traditional breakpoint. So there's a lot of buffers that need to be put in place, and the ditches systems are one of them. And we've got some guidance that's coming forth from the state that will help these local drainage authorities who are ready to do it to take on approaches like has been done in Freeborn County and other places to do it systematically. We've also got some funding for them to modernize their records. Most of these systems were constructed back in the early 1900s, you know, with handwritten notes and ledgers and hand-drawn maps, and those are legal documents that are important to how these systems are maintained and funded in the future. We want to make sure those records are preserved and modernized. And then we've also got a drainage assistance team available in the near future that will help local drainage authorities get technical and legal expertise to do this kind of improvements to their systems if they're interested in that. So I'll leave it at that. We saw some very good sites. We almost got enough wind in 1 hour there to last a lifetime, but that's the weather we get these days. So there's a handout that describes some of the things that have happened in the last session. There's also a continuing effort by this drainage work group to work on ideas that could enhance the way we manage those systems going into the future as well, and that work group will continue to put forth ideas, and likely many of them will come before this committee for consideration in this year or years to come. So with that, I will take any questions or comments.
Any questions? Okay. Mr. Jeschke, we did see, I think it was in the Turtle Creek watershed, a drainage system that was going to be dammed and a wetland restored. Mm-hmm. And I believe the administrator said that there were 15 plans that were drawn up in the 70s. And we heard earlier tonight, I think, about plans drawn up in the 50s. And I think all the professionals that are behind you probably have seen plans for one thing or the other. And I don't want to discount planning, because I understand what the watershed Zumbra was saying, but at some point, we have to do the work. And I think that we see this coming from to the legislature, to the Legislative Citizens Commission of Minnesota Resources. And we can look at things every 20 years to do the plan, but at some point, we have to do the work. And I think that that's maybe I'm speaking for my peers here, that we see all these planning proposals. And it was kind of shocking that, you know, we have to dust off the 1970s plans that were good work was done, but the issue is still the same 30 years later. So, and that's not to discount past legislatures or past officials. Everybody reacts to the funding needs that we have, but when we have the opportunity to put the projects in the ground, we want to do it if the planning has been good. So,
yeah, just Mr. Chairman, one comment on that. I think Ms. Dahl actually was at one of the sites that we saw, and you know, there's a difference between a concept plan and one that's more of a blueprint that actually says here's exactly the way the nails and the timber need to be nailed together to get the job done. That's the kind of planning that, if it hasn't been done, you know, we think is what's necessary so that we spend our resources, limited as they are, in the most important places, and being able to craft our programs to be more targeted based on those blueprints, if you will, for conservation in a watershed, and that's the way I think the trend is going. And so planning can get a bad name, I understand that, especially when the plans don't actually ever turn into action. But we think that plans that are of that sufficient detail can stimulate action and funding. So, all right, I will continue then. The last item on my agenda tonight was to just give you a summary of kind of where we're at and where we're going to be going with this state-federal conservation opportunity matrix. I did this in a little bit of haste early this morning, so if I put draft on it, then I still need to change it. And things will change because we don't know what the federal farm bill is going to be. We have a bill passed by the House, and the federal Senate has passed the bill, and they have to now figure out how to get it together and get the administration to sign off. So, but what's happened in Minnesota, this chart you see here has got a dark line, and the dark line indicates kind of where, what above it is what's happened, and what is below it is what could happen. It looks like this, and then the back there's a map which I'll refer to in a minute. The first line on this chart indicates that we had a opportunity that we were pursuing some number of months ago in the past legislative session where we were going to be able to use $8 million of our state conservation easement funds and reinvest in Minnesota to leverage about $15 million of the Wetland Reserve Program dollars that the USDA would have. And, of course, the strikeout there means the bill didn't happen at the state level. And so that $15 million, which was sitting in St. Paul, went back to Washington, D.C., and, it got used to some other purpose. So hard for us in the state of Minnesota who believe in conservation to see that happen, and that was disappointing, but that's the way it worked out. And so we're ready for next year, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The next line there is really focused on this flood relief legislation that did appropriate some new funds in the conservation area, and one of the things that we're working on is to line up those funds with these USDA funds, which are likely to come but aren't yet here, so we can't count on them, and we're doing what we can to make sure we're ready to receive those dollars and not disqualify ourselves from getting those. I talked with Bill Hunt, who's a state conservationist at NRCS, and they've gotten a new, these are a number of acronyms here. I think probably most of the folks behind me know what they are because they work with us every day, but these are federal programs that are available for watershed management. Let's say EWP is for watershed management, to basically go back and do some of the landscape restoration work. ECP is to put working land or farmland back into farmland condition after a flooding event. And EQIP is the cost share practices, which bank stabilization and so forth. So we're looking to leverage those programs and make the most of the federal investment here too. So that money is available through June of 08, and as I mentioned before, we may want to get some extension on that if necessary coming out of this session. We'll be looking at that. The other thing I should point out is the EQIP dollars that are mentioned there, the $500,000 or up to $21 million statewide, that they've allocated $500,000 for this Southeast flood response. They're looking to try and get that all done by December, which is an unbelievable schedule because they want to be ready for the new farm bill, which may or may not happen. So that's a soft deadline, but one that they're trying to work with. So all this means is that all this money is available if we can figure out ways to deliver it to willing landowners and then be able to do the design and technical assistance needed to get it accomplished. So that's kind of where we're at. Then below that line is a description of the opportunities ahead, and you heard others mention the upcoming bonding bill that will be considered this session. The first two lines are basically the same. They're representing two federal fiscal years, and we expect that there will be about $20 million in each year of the new farm bill, which we expect this program to be part of that. And the reality is that in order to make it viable for landowners, we've got to come up with a state matching portion for that federal money to get the conservation acres on the ground. These represent wetland restorations permanently on the landscape, with native vegetation buffers adjacent to them. And then the last point on this list is that we have a federal program. Everyone has heard about it, the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP. And that's a short-term conservation program. Land retirement, reinvest in Minnesota is a long-term conservation program, mostly permanent, other long-term easements. You flip the page over, you can see a map. It's in black and white, and I apologize for that because I was doing it this morning by myself, and I'm not capable to run the color copier. But the just forget about the northeastern Minnesota. There aren't any CRP acres up there, so that's the 0 to 250 category. But these are acres of CRP land that is going to be is eligible to be coming out of conservation and put back into production if the landowner so chooses. And that's a lot of acres in Minnesota and across this country. And because of the commodity prices, you know, being good, which is a good thing, you know, people are interested in putting some of that land back into production. And the state of Minnesota is not ever going to be able to go and replicate that program. But we do believe that there are some high priority areas within those acres that should be preserved in long-term conservation rather than having them go back into production and coming back in years ahead and having them trying to be put back into conservation. And so we'd like to be able to go in and work with these willing landowners to offer them long-term conservation options to keep the wetlands that have been restored, to keep the riparian buffers that have been put in place. And that's what this portion of the bonding bill that you're going to be seeing in one way, shape, or form this session is looking like coming from our agency's perspective. So that's my looking ahead a little bit on these programs.
Any questions from members? Checking. Is there anyone out who has signed up for public testimony? No one has signed up. I'd give the opportunity maybe for a few moments if somebody wants to address the committee. If no one wants to address the committee, I can also put, yes, there's someone.
Good evening. My name is Jan Blevins. I'm a member of what we call the Olmsted County Concerned Citizens. Our concern lies mainly with our water resource. Right at this point, we're looking at an impossible ethanol production plant in our area. Very karst region, an area that is, they would be taking water out of one of our pristine aquifers, the Jordan. We look at that as sometimes fighting ethanol, you feel almost un-American. But I do believe that all the representatives and politicians need to relook at this whole issue. There are many reasons. We have trout streams in our area. We have groundwater that you're trying to protect. We have good drinking water that these plants that want to use, and there's very few that are going to benefit from it, mainly the investors. There's a lot that are going to not benefit from it. In many states right now, they're facing drought conditions. They're facing water supplies that are just not regenerating and refurbishing. So that's one of the things I would just like to ask, is that you relook at this issue. You help us protect our streams, our springs, our groundwater, and our wetlands. That's what I ask.
Thank you. Representative Beginius.
We should let you know that there is another subcommittee. This is Wetlands, Watersheds, and Buffers. And there's another subcommittee called Protecting Drinking Water Sources, which will be meeting on Thursday in Dakota County to listen to some of start looking at the drinking water source protection issues, because folks do realize that we do not have a plan for sustainable drinking water in Minnesota right now. We don't even have a definition. And so the overall problem, I mean, I don't know anything about your specific issue, but the overall problem is one that we do recognize.
I'd like to give the opportunity for anyone else to address the committee. I did make a mistake early. I didn't give the other members the chance to introduce themselves. And I know that Representative Gunther at least has some other things he wants to say, because he said a lot on the tour. So I do want to give the members, and maybe while members are speaking for a little bit, someone else will want to address the group. So Representative Osmond, just to say hello or any comments. Because I didn't say you could introduce, I didn't introduce everybody. So really,
well, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here and to listen to this. This is a very topic that all of us need to be paying attention to, and I'm really pleased that you know, through your leadership, we're going to continue to give it that kind of attention.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Jean Wagenius, representative from South Minneapolis. So you can see that folks in the big cities share many of your concerns.
Representative Gunther.
I'm Representative Gunther. He told me to ask a lot of questions.
From Fairmont. Martin Connor.
I'm Representative Jean Poppy from Austin, and I was not able to go along on the tour today, but I appreciate that you went through my district in Austin and Maurer County, but you also went to my home area, which is Looney Valley area, so you were able to see what truly what the flooding has done, and I've been there myself to see some of that and know from my experience in Austin how floods can dramatically impact and damage land and people, and how that's a great concern. So I appreciate that you did that.
Well, thank you, Hardy. Presented earlier, just gave some opening comments, but in conclusion, and maybe somebody else will still want to come up and present, but, you know, as I thought about this, when I got the call from Representative Hansen, and he said, well, we're going to come down to southeastern Minnesota, and we're going to have a tour, and he said, you know, would you like to have the opportunity to have a forum in your area? I thought, I've been hearing about these issues for years, and I grew up on a dairy and crop farm just outside of Plainview. Andy Hart doesn't live that many miles away. The farmers in our area have been very progressive in implementing conservation practices, and yet I still hear farmers in our area talk about the conservation practices that they've seen in the past that are no longer in place. And so we have many challenges, and I think this hearing tonight was a great opportunity for you to see what southeastern Minnesota has to offer as far as our natural resources. But more importantly, it was our opportunity to share with you our story of what we've seen over the past years. And as you saw with the group that presented and the other individual testifiers that presented here tonight, we have a lot of challenges, but we've also been putting into place a lot of very meaningful and effective practices. And I hope what we can take away from this evening, and Representative Hansen, I hope your committee can take it away from here. I serve on the Agriculture Committee. Representative Poppy serves on the Agriculture Committee. I know the other members around here serve on many of the committees that can actually have an impact on implementing what we've been speaking about this evening and what the testifiers have been alluding to. And so it's my hope that we take this information back to St. Paul, and in this legislative session, we put some initiative behind it and get some of these effective and meaningful proposals put into place and put into practice.
And I'll make one more call if anyone else wants to address the committee and mention that I represent South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, Lilydale, and a little bit of Eagan. But I grew up in a little town of Freeborn in Freeborn County in a ditch system. We went through St. Charles, where my cousins live. My mother taught in both Plainview and Stuartville, I believe, before she taught up on the range, got her degree at Winona. She was from Harmony on Iona Farm, south of Niagara Cave, where my mom grew up. And so, and I think I was involved with pesticide applicator training in most of these areas when I worked at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And so I've worked in many of this area. We do plan on looking around the state, because one thing that's clear about Minnesota is we're a big state and we have a lot of very diverse resources. And I think we see, you know, just in the tour we went today from the flat peat ground in Hollandale, Maple Island, across to Houston, and the topography changes, the resource changes, and really not that much of a drive. We pass legislation, but you have to implement it. And what you implement here may be different than what's implemented in Red River Valley or on the North Shore or in southwestern Minnesota. And so we plan on hearing from the public, listening more, and trying to make sure that we're doing the best we can to make sure that you can get the job done locally. And so I thank you for coming tonight. I'll offer one more time if anybody else wants to address us, and appreciate the good turnout here on this November night. If there's no one else, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you.